This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Hello everyone. My name is John Spear. I'm Executive Director of the Australian Institute for Social Research at the University of Adelaide. And it's my very great pleasure on behalf of the Festival of Ideas to welcome you here today to this very special event towards the end of the Festival of Ideas on this beautiful warm day here in Adelaide. I'd just like to acknowledge that we're meeting on the land of the Kaurna people and we respect their spiritual relationship with the land. Again, welcome to the Festival of Ideas, the theme of which is The Big Lie. Just before we get underway, I'd like to ask you to switch your mobile phones off or turn them onto silent. And you're most welcome, if you're a tweeter, to tweet. And the tweet is at Ideas Adelaide. And our hashtag is #AFOI. Today's speaker is well known to all of us. It's Bob Ellis. Bob's author of And So It Went, The Capitalism Delusion, 100 Days of Summer, and Suddenly Last Winter. Bob's book on economics, First Abolish the Customer, was, as we say now, on the money. Co-authoring the musical, The Legend of King O'Malley, the miniseries The True Believers, and the Ben Chifley play A Local Man. He wrote and directed the feature films Unfinished Business and The Nostradamus Kid. He wrote speeches for Kim Beazley, Bob Carr, for Mike Rann, Nathan Rees, and many others. In 1994, he stood as an independent against Bronwyn Bishop and gained, with her political puncturing, an energy and enduring national fame. Can you please join me in welcoming Bob Ellis?
Thank you all. When driving north-northwest, as I sometimes do, from Melbourne to Adelaide, I find myself sometimes in twilight, engulfed by green and fertile plains and hills round Ararat in the Western District. A great bonus of countryside, the size of half of England, with very few people in it. And I pull over and drink some orange juice and look out at the surrounding, fading beauty, and wonder how many Hazara peasants and their sons and wives could fruitfully till the soil here on small holdings, growing things. Is it 500,000? A million? Or how many cities the size of Newcastle could be sustained here? 3, 4, if the rains and floods kept coming and were piped to places of need, recycled, purified, desalinated, poured down into hot rocks to come up as steam that powers electricity and is then, and therefore, clean enough to drink. Why not? I ask. And I drive on into the dark. Sometimes I go to Adelaide by train from Sydney and in dawn go past the Menindi Lakes, as big now as Lake Erie, and wonder why no fish are being farmed here, no waterside restaurants built, no grey mud beauty cream harvested as it is from the Dead Sea. Is it truly because the lakes will recede and not be there in 10 years' time? Or is it another reason? We are told we must not let the boat people in part because they jumped the queue, preferring not to have their children caned and sodomised and whored and fed drugs and undereducated in Malaysia, but in part because Australia cannot sustainably hold more than, what, 25 million, 35 million people, ever? And our Asian neighbours think this is a really strange thing to say. They look at a continent two-thirds as big as China, which has 1.4 billion people, two-thirds of which is 900 million people. And they wonder, where do we get off? And how dare we? And I look at the map, and I find that Bob Catter's electorate embracing most of the northern thrust of Queensland, mostly green and fertile, is as big as Great Britain and has 90,000 people in it. And Tony Crook's electorate, which is only half desert, is as big as Scandinavia and has 90,000 people in it. And Mike Kelly's electorate, green, fertile, beach-fronted, ski-lodged and cheese-producing, is as big as Israel and has 90,000 people in it. And I look at Tasmania, which is as big as Ireland and mostly green and fertile and has 600,000 people in it, unlike Ireland, which has 4 million. The Maralinga lands, given back to their people by Mike Rann, are the size of Belgium. The far north coast of New South Wales, from Taree into Quirindi and up to Tenterfield, Nimbin and Tweed Heads and back down the coast to Taree, is the size of Massachusetts, Vermont and Rhode Island put together, and has only 400,000 people, compared with those parts of New England, no more fertile, no more richly soiled and freshly watered, which boast 9 million people. So what are we talking about here? A genuine crisis in our carrying capacity in a parched land that is full up, or something else? And let's leave aside the Ord River catchment area, as big as Denmark, the Murrumbidgee irrigation area, as big as Wales, the Snowy River high country, bigger than Switzerland, southeast Queensland, as big as Macedonia, and try to find out, following, as it were, the paper trail or the water trail, why we really fear immigration from Asia of people not of our religion into our cities and pastures and country towns. We are told it's because we don't have the water to sustain much life here, that this is the driest continent. Well, I'm not sure continent is a useful word in any argument that we might have on any subject on this planet. Asia is probably the coldest inhabited continent, but it contains Saudi Arabia, India, Sri Lanka. Africa is the most food-rich continent, potentially so, though 5,000 children starve there every day. And Australia is the driest continent, with the thinnest topsoil. But, well, the topsoil's pretty deep round Murrumbidgee, and the rain abundant and provident in the Tweed and Richmond valleys. The deep-soiled, well-watered parts of Australia are bigger than half of non-British Europe. Why say continent at all? Continent is not a useful word. We should never use it again in any context. It is a fraudulent word, a waste of ink, a waste of breath. And what we have here, sure, for sure, is a big lie. A lie as big as terra nullius. However innocently it was arrived at. A lie as big as the notion that Israel was an underpopulated, savage desert place before 1948, when the bulldozers levelled the towns and the armies at gunpoint, pushed out people resident there 1,000 years. To provide a terra nullius in which to build a new Jerusalem, free of the memory of the old. It is a big lie, and there is plenty of room. And we have to ask why this big lie, Australia deserta, was innocently arrived at, or maliciously told. Innocently, well, after Burke and Wills and Edward John Eyre and the hardships of Dad and Dave on their selection and the dust-blowing droughts that so formed the sunburnt souls of Henry Lawson, Barcroft Boak, Xavier Herbert and John Williamson, one could be forgiven for thinking Australia a dry, inhospitable, unreliable, ecologically cantankerous place. This is only if you think of it as an ill-equipped 19th century sharecropper would, not as a 21st century minerals industry CEO or a tourist hotel owner with a bedroom view of Uluru. It's then as hospitable and population-friendly as Palm Springs is, or Vegas, or the Grand Canyon, or Los Angeles. You only have to pipe water in. And as to the question of water, to put it a little vulgarly, the sea is full of it. And its level could be brought down just a bit by piping some of it into South Australia, where desal plants powered by hot rocks, wind or solar, could turn it cheaply into potable water, or shaving water, or garden water. Australia deserta, or Terra Australis deserta, as some medieval cartographer might call it, the big lie, was innocently born of 19th century eyes and powerful words and word clusters like the outback and the Birdsville track and the back of beyond and the never, never stopped us measuring what we had in cane-growing coastlands and wheat-growing inlands and the cattle-farming north and the apple-growing south and the once fish-teeming rivers and blizzard-blowing ski-lodge mountain valleys as big as Switzerland. And as John Ford said, we printed the legend and we believed in it. That's if we got there to this conclusion innocently. Though some in this room, I imagine, did, and were not encoiled into a larger racist fantasia of prized possession of a blessed place and repelling the swarthy heathens who want to take it from us, as in tomorrow when the war began, and want to take it soon. Is it just the Hughes, Curtin, Menzies myth of the yellow peril overwhelming in their invading millions and insistent sperm, our proud British stock, that drives this parsimonious fantasy, this frugal superstition, that there is no room at the inn for anyone but our own post-Christian Anglo-Celtic grandchildren and the odd Japanese chef, the odd buxom Ukrainian waitress to feed them, or the odd Russian bride to breed their blue-eyed children? Or is it something deeper, something more primally transmitted, something deep in our DNA? This question should be asked. Why is it boats that so affright us and not aeroplanes? Not aeroplanes loaded as they eventually are with immigrant illegals. I believe myself the reason lies in race memory of the medieval plague. Boats, if you remember, leaky hulks with rotten cargo and rats and fleas, brought the plague to England and Europe from the Middle East and North Africa, and a third of England died. And we somehow remember this, and we search on arrival and probe on arrival each Middle Eastern or Muslim boat person for disease. In a way, we do not search and probe any English round the world yachtsman, or Jessica Watson, or Willem Dafoe, or Hillary Clinton, or Kevin Rudd, though they have been as far and as deep into disease-bearing latitudes as any Palestinian refugee. We have this image of menace by boat, a tall ship with black sails, so well evoked in the Threepenny Opera and also in Pirates of the Caribbean, that bears a cargo of ill fortune, of kidnap and pillage and syphilitic rape, an image as old as Greece in its war with Persia, of advancing seaborne menace we must repulse with might and main and virgin sacrifice, which in our day continues and is shouted from the rooftops by Tony Abbott. Stop the boats, he bellows in war cry, but never stop the refugees. It is the boats and their disease he starts us thinking of and fearing, not the talented little children within them or their frantic pregnant mothers watching our naval vessels approach and praying to their sky god to make us Australians wise providers of their need. It is the boats we fear, and fear primarily, and not the goat-herding mountain Shiites who would prosper here and make good slaughter men and nurses and brain surgeons and old age carers and Sanskrit scholars and husbands for lonely school teachers. And it's because of the boats we have invented the myth and printed the legend of Australia Desertar, when our ecology is agog with possibilities. We have an inland sea now, and we could breed fish in it while it is here. Australia is a net importer of fish, despite our 27,000-mile coastline, and this to me seems fucking ridiculous. We could make the Menindee Lakes a hive of trout and salmon and export megatons of them to Japan while the lakes last. And we do not know for certain they will ever go away. But if they do, well, what will we do if the desert returns and we become again the driest continent instead of what we are now, one of the wettest and swampiest? What do we do to house and heal and feed the multitudes now breeding in Uruguayan and Aceh and Syria and Sri Lanka, who may soon choose to ask us for shelter and succour and sanctuary on our none too fatal shore? Well, we should think a bit and revolve in our minds the twin thoughts that, lo and behold, the desert does bloom because it has. And the desert, in order to bloom, needs, well, it needs not so much rainfall as water. And where is it to come from? In California, which is desert, it comes in pipes from snow-topped mountains 400 miles away. In Kuwait, which is desert, it comes in pipes from the desalinated Red Sea. Don Dunstan had an idea of towing some icebergs north and feeding them as ice cubes into Adelaide's reservoirs. But there are other means to the end of nourishing the refugee millions who soon will be sharing our green and gold and sand-blown, mine-gouged, beach-proud, water-scarce, blue-remembered hills and Kookaburra chuckling suburbs, if we let them in. Israel found in their Desert Bloom project the deep, underlying, brackish desert water, in which South Australia is richly abundant, made sweeter tomatoes and bigger strawberries and fatter bananas and statelier red roses than normal clean snow melt water by a factor of about 32%. Looked at that way, thought on that way, suddenly our desert is a garden. And the 50,000 Hazara peasant farmers currently keen to come here, suddenly and surprisingly a boost and a boon and a bonanza to our economy. They would also be of help in the difficult matter of camel milk. There are 500,000 camels in South Australia, and camel milk, as is well known, mitigates diabetes and lasts 10 months when refrigerated and is therefore a multi-billion dollar export. But the difficulty is how to get it. Well, you have to sneak up on a mother camel feeding her eager baby and, as it were, grasp her attention without losing her respect. It can be done, but it requires a lot of running, jumping, lassoing, tying down and praying to Allah. And of course, Hazaras would be good at this. And we could make, oh, 10 billion a year, halve diabetes worldwide, make productive use of our desert, and so on. Hazaras might be useful also in growing and tending and reaping non-hallucinogenic marijuana in great northern forests and turning it into chairs, tables, chopsticks, cloth-bound novels, T-shirts, trousers, curtains, carpets and blankets. And with it sequestering more and more carbon as it swiftly grows and is swiftly cut down. Thereby, I guess, delaying for a century or two the world's end. On 20-acre allotments rented from Aboriginal peoples or shared by them. In newly watered places now judged desert or back of beyond. By cartographers under-informed of human progress and modern possibilities. Or they could be licensed to fish in the new vast continuing inland sea, or grow oysters, or teach water skiing there. And thus, by intricate adjustments to an altering ecology, provide the tax base for the comfort of us baby boomers grown old and rancorous in crowded and filthy nursing homes in the 2020s and 30s. I know I mention the Hazaras a lot, and it's because, well, I know a few by heart. And to me and my children, they look like Mediterranean Australians, most of them, those that do not exactly resemble Ricky Ponting. And their industrious, parsimonious, hard-working family values put me in mind of the Anatevka Jews in Fiddler on the Roof, dispersed and exiled by the Russian pogroms, Jews from whom I descend. And I resent the idea, affected but not believed by our Prime Minister, that they are a problem that should be finally solved by their resettlement in Malaysia. Jobless, resented, ill-schooled, enslaved, pious, mocked, persecuted and festering at the end of an endless queue, and considering at long last, some of them, terrorism as a career option. And if the inland sea dries up, well, there are pipes, there is water. A big enough pipe could transfer the Fly River into the Darling, or the Laclo in East Timor into the Drysdale in Western Australia. And there is coastal storm water that could be sucked up after storms and driven in tankers to grey water reservoirs in towns with a need of it. Water, you see, is not the problem, or it is not the problem any longer. Water can now be made, and living space, Lebensraum, Hitler called it, is not the problem. There is a continent one-third as big as Africa, full of it. Race is not the problem. Nearly all of them look like us. Sustainable numbers, therefore, are not the problem either. That thought, that phrase, that question, that mischievous hypothesis is a big lie. The problem seems to be that we do not like women wearing certain headgear, or men praying loudly five times a day to an angry deity we do not much like the smell of, with his multiple wives and hatred of dogs and pig meat. And this is the fear we have disguised beneath the very, very dodgy theory of Lebensraum, Hitler's excuse for exterminating, or as he put it, relocating another Semitic people. Elbow room for the Übermensch, the Anglo-Celts, and our lesser Mediterranean cousins. Lebensraum for the Euro-Aryan supermen. Us. So, how many do you think? Let's not be too ambitious. Let's look at the world's most successful, most prosperous, and yes, multicultural and conscienceful functioning democracy, Germany. It's three quarters the size of Western Australia. It has 82 million people and will have 90 million people by 2025. Let's begin to match it. Let's take in all the 170,000 queued up refugees in Malaysia and Indonesia. Let's pay whatever Hazaras who want to come here to do so. thus easing much of the divided, reft and blood-stained anguish of Afghanistan. Let's ask what country towns and cities would like some refugees. Let's put them in caravan parks outside or in those towns. Give them the unemployment benefit and the caravan rent and a bicycle and the use of the local schools. And see how it goes. If we do this in the next 5 years, we may have a population of 25 million by decade's end, with as many young people working in it as are needed to subsidise the swollen bubble of the old. A better country and a better society, and a better feeling within ourselves of what Australia hereafter must mean. All those in favour?
Now, Bob, I think our mics should work here so we can continue the conversation, and in a few minutes I'll get you involved. I'm sure there are plenty of questions from the audience. Thanks very much for that incredibly thoughtful and provoking contribution today. I'm sure it's one of the more provoking here at the Festival of Ideas. Bob, population politics hasn't been too edifying in Australia in the last decade, has it?
No.
Where do we go from here with population politics?
In brief, in 1975, Malcolm Fraser won by a landslide an election. In 1976 and 77, a great number of boat people from Vietnam began to arrive. And he took the principled view that since they were fleeing from a war in which we had participated, we therefore had an obligation to take them in. And he began this process, and eventually 200,000 of them were allowed in. And in 1977, he won the election by the same margin, which proves that if a leader takes a principled stand on this issue, the public will tend to go with him. John Howard did exactly the opposite, and the public, of course, went with him. And I don't know if it's curable, if it's upliftable back to the Fraser position, but I hope so. I think people do tend to follow public men in their views on difficult subjects if those views are eloquently put. Nobody resented much what Keating said of the Aborigines and Hawke said of the massacre in Beijing and so on, with tears in his eyes. It's silly to say it requires only leadership, but it requires that eloquence which adds to leadership, the power to convince.
It seems that it's a difficult subject that we're going to have to take on if you are a believer in climate change science. Where do you see the intersection between climate change and population taking the debate?
I don't know. I mean, I'm divided on things. I'm told by a madman who harasses me at my grocer's shop every morning that it's not carbon, it's the effluent, the nutrient in the sewage of the human race, which is warming the oceans, which is causing the tornadoes, which is causing the lightning storms, which is causing the nightmare we're in. And this emphasis on carbon and the impossibility of persuading international corporations to behave well is the wrong trail. We should actually just be piping the sewage into South Australia and building building mountains on which snow will fall.
We have two microphones, one in the centre and I think one up the back there, so if you'd like to ask a question of Bob, please come down and take advantage of this opportunity. Don't be shy. Sorry? You'd like to hear a bit more of that?
About what?
The
nutrient, oh yeah. Well, this bloke, who is a marine biologist, he was once a roustabout at the age of 14, and he had to water the horses. And it was found that the horses at night would not drink the water, and it was because a scum had formed on the surface, which made the water hot. And the water was actually hot, ordinary water, because of this nutrient process of which I speak. And according to him, and I think he's right, it's destroyed the seagrass and the fish stock of the northern rivers of New South Wales and of the entire Solomon Islands, where fishermen can no longer fish anymore because there are no more fish. They're not being bred because of the human waste nutrient raising tremendously the surface temperature of the sea, which then causes, you know, the president of Poland to die in a lightning storm on his way to Russia, you know. By the butterfly effect.
Yes.
Ruth Russell from Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. I'm interested, Bob, in your analysis of the future for Australia, thinking for our region. Currently, we are completely complicit with the US through our alliance. We know in the region the future is like to either, there are probably three options, one, a military or a fight between the dominance of US and rising China, China becoming the hegemon due to their economic power, which will influence our whole region. And the a third scenario that I'm interested in progressing is that Australia uses its influence as a middle power to say to all the players in our region, can we ask the US and China to share power and it will be a win-win for everyone? I just wonder how you see it, because I think we need to start thinking. You've focused on the current issues, but what are the current plans or the future possibilities for our region? Thanks.
Thanks, Ruth.
I think you are predicated on the premise that the US has or had or has ever had power. Yeah, there's no strong evidence for this. They cannot persuade Netanyahu to stop building apartments. They had nothing to do with the Arab Spring. They could not rescue their own people from Hurricane Katrina in a fit. They are not very good at anything, and they can occasionally target and assassinate a man who's living blatantly in what amounts to a Duntroon. after discovering he's the only 7 foot tall person in the region, you know. They're not that clever. And they owe the farm to China, which will probably foreclose and take out Alaska as down payment soon. I do not think there is much to negotiate between America and China. There's a lot to negotiate with China. Like, please give us back our Tasmanian farms and so on. I don't know. I think an atomised world is coming. A balkanised world is coming. When the drachma is back, and it was around for 3,000 years and it should never have gone away. Mark Antony's promised more of it over the corpse of Caesar in 44 BC. Once the euro breaks up, and America's debt to China becomes terminal. And once a China spring begins, you may well have an agreeable sort of version of the United Nations, which is very welcome, I think, of nations acting in their own interests with their own currency and their own trade tariff barriers, you know. And subsidising their own primary industries and so on. I don't think there's much to do except watch it all fall down.
Yes.
Bob, you have painted for us a word picture of the future based on a larger population and water, which will be ample for our needs, especially focusing on irrigation. And it reminded me a bit of the great dreams of the last century when particularly veterans were exploited. They were given blocks of land and told it was land fit for heroes, and they were expected to turn Mallee into productive land. And they broke their backs and they broke their hearts. So are you really confident that people, these Azaras, will be more successful? And secondly, when irrigation did work along our riverland, for example, it's led to a lot of soil degradation and salinisation and bringing ancient salt to the surface, which really would have been better to leave down there. And it seems like it's not going to really be a sustainable means of food production. Even land we have been able to use is becoming unusable. And when it does work, we produce food surpluses which then get dumped, like the last wine harvest, and we've all seen oranges dumped and burned. So what makes you so optimistic that this dream is actually going to work? I found it a bit light on evidence and facts that could give me optimism. So I welcome your a few facts and, you know, something to back up the nice dream, because it's a lovely dream.
I put high hopes in camel shit. I think, if I might...
You're right.
Here? Yeah. I mean, obviously there is a great deal in what you say, but there is also a great deal in the evidence we have lately seen after the floods of how much can grow and be grown in what seems presently to be desert. And the soil degradation, you know, certainly occurs, but by God, there's a lot of desert that's not particularly degraded, and it's blooming so well that Mad Max 4 is now being shot in Namibia. They couldn't find desert enough to shoot Mad Max in. This is very, very powerful evidence. I mean, I hear what you say, and I'm reminded of those great lines by, what's his name, the Tasmanian poet, northeast across the water, Brobdingnag, that's China, casts its momentous shadows on the sea, and fills the sky with thunder, but they smile and sit on their verandas taking tea, watching through the quiet afternoons flood, fire and cyclone in successive motion complete the work their ancestors began of shifting all the soil into the ocean. And I mean, it's certainly happening, but soil is not just soil, you know, it's the consequence of leaves falling and trees growing and camel shit accumulating in great amounts in South Australia. It can be argued either way.
Yes.
I've been told not to ask this question, but the biggest lie is that cannabis is a dangerous drug of addiction.
Cannabis is a dangerous drug of addiction.
That's the biggest lie.
No, it is a dangerous drug of addiction. It doesn't cause, but it accelerates schizophrenia. And many of my generation became foolish, paranoid fearers of the CIA coming after them with machine guns as a result of that drug.
Does this occur in Holland?
What?
Does this occur in Holland? Higher schizophrenia rate in Holland, where it's legal?
I don't know. I mean, it's not a question of whether it's legal. It's a question of whether it's abundant, you know. Mm-hmm. And where it's abundant, say in Glebe, there are paranoids everywhere.
Can I just say there's a microphone available up on the balcony too, if you would like to ask a question from up on the balcony as well. But we'll just go to the middle here.
Yeah, returning to the subject of farming in the regions, I too share some of the concerns of the woman who spoke very well before about attempts to turn Mallee scrub into productive land and how heartbreaking that can be. But on a positive note, I think probably the most heartening thing I heard Bob say was, let's ask people in regions, in small towns, who's looking for more people, who would like to accept lots of refugees into their area.
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising. Apparently there are a lot of Tasmanian towns. There's Albury, Wodonga, there's Longreach. There are places like this which are busting for what amounts to Afghan, you know, farm workers and so on. It's a curious fact that the racism does not exist in the country towns. It exists in the outer suburbs of many places. But people who in Young met Afghans who came there as meat workers were enchanted by them and grieved when they were taken away. And Kosovans who came to Wodonga were equally grieved when sent back home to Sarajevo or something. I mean, it's their racism. It's a strange word. It really means otherism. It means cultureism or something like that. It doesn't. Where such folk are needed, they are always welcome.
Any other questions? Well, for no other questions, if you could please join me in thanking Bob Ellis.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.